Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room, and on Instagram at the Rambling Ravenpuffs.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/therambling ravenpuffs, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in. Grab your butterbeer and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Ravenpuffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we're covering chapters 13 and 14 of The Chamber of Secrets, The Very Secret Diary, and Cornelius Fudge. In these chapters, Harry finds a magical book, even more magical than the usual ones at this school. And another corrupt politician facilitates the arrest of a man already known to be innocent.
Yeah. It's surprising to me sometimes how much adult, like the politics and things like that, get involved in these stories. And the end of, I think that was the second chapter we read, that took me by surprise.
But we'll start with chapter 13. So what did you think about chapter 13?
Yeah, I thought they did a really great job of portraying Valentine's Day and how just like gross it is to be a kid and have to go through that. I remember those days at school. Wasn't getting a lot of Valentines. I'm just going to say that. But a lot happens. I feel like we say that, or I say that every chapter. And I also was really grateful that the Quidditch match got canceled, but I was also surprised at who canceled it. So how was your revisit?
Yeah, because you know shit is really bad if McGonagall's canceling Quidditch.
Exactly my thoughts. I'm like, it's got to be at the extreme.
Someone died.
Right, exactly. How was your revisit of this chapter?
I'm not being really spoiler here, but this is not the first time that we will see memory sequences in this series. So, but it does mark the beginning of, you know, we get that, and we get it in a pretty unique way. Again, you don't know yet, the sort of mechanism they use to look at memories is totally different. Like, this is a very unique way through an enchanted book. Like, we don't see this again.
Interesting. Okay, I'm trying to, oh, yeah. And we are introduced to a name that I recognize, and I know who this character is. So
You do remember. Okay.
I do. Sure. I think I've done enough like Googling. You know, I'm very silly about like, I want to know what's going on, even if I'm not like reading the thing. So for some reason the name Tom Riddle would always pop up and I'm like, why is this so hilarious? Or like, why is this meme? And I'll be like, oh, so this was years before we talked. I knew he was not a good guy, but anyway, I'm jumping ahead.
So we start off where Hermione, you know, has to, you know, she doesn't get released until like early February. So she was in the hospital wing for over a month.
Yeah, the consequences of this action or this, you know, seemingly small mistake are pretty bad. But typical Hermione, she is not going to let that get her down. She's going to continue to research what she needs to research.
And it's just interesting, the notion of, you know, just resting and relaxing over like the feeling of, you know, productivity. Because I had a few students who work under me, like student workers, who caught COVID.
Oh, no.
And, you know, they were fine. Their symptoms were mild. Like there weren't any bad after effects or nothing lingered. But, you know, I told them, when she told me, I was just like, you know, you can like not do the work I originally assigned you, right? And she's like, no, please, I'm stuck here. I have nothing else to do. I want to feel normal.
That's interesting. I feel like it always varies, like to two extremes. Sometimes you just like want to do absolutely nothing or something, you know, to take your mind off things. And, you know, I don't, dealing with grief and sometimes I'm just like, I just need to keep my mind busy, but then things will just catch me off guard and I'll just be like, oh, there's the thing that I'm avoiding. So, but it's not really, she's not really avoiding anything. I mean, she's just.
I think it just shows, I think it's in specifically with COVID-19, the isolationist aspect of it, which is not like, if maybe she were just like a normal sick and, you know, maybe she would just like take a load off, but she was like, no, I want to pretend that this isn't happening basically.
Yeah. Can't really blame her for that, I guess. Well, and then she's keeping, I thought this was kind of cute. And then also kind of just the way Lockhart is portrayed. She has a card from the teachers under her pillow or something like that. And then they give her kind of a hard time about that. But that's okay.
Yeah. How did you feel about that card?
I don't know. I mean, I think her being like having a little crush is like, it's not a surprise for like a girl that age, but the action of Lockhart giving her that card, I don't know.
I thought it was kind of creepy because I think he's, you know, he's not doing it because he actually, you know, probably cares about Hermione. He throws her like a breadcrumb because she will bolster this image he has of himself.
Yes, he, that's a great point. He is definitely one of these people that, and I feel like I've known a few in my day that as long as it makes that, you know, him look good, he'll do it. You know, really, there's no like really true intention there. So interesting.
But yeah, it just, for as much as Lockhart is, you know, seeking admiration and the fact that Hermione is a girl, like, I don't know, maybe I'm just really sick, but like I always had it in my head canon that Lockhart's probably having like student teacher affairs with some of like the older girl students.
I could see that. I'm not going to say anything more than that because I could see that. That's all. I mean, that's what I'll say. It seems similar to some people I've encountered in life.
Oh dear.
Not me. Please, everybody. I am not one of those people, but just kind of that sort of professor.
And then they leave Hermione and hospital wing, and then they hear Filch, and Filch is like throwing a little tantrum again. So apparently the bathroom, Morty Myrtle's bathroom, has flooded again, and they find her and she's like upset, and Harry's like, what's up? It's like, come back to throw something else at me. Why would I throw something at you? Don't ask me, Myrtle shouted, emerging with a wave of yet more water, which splashed onto the already sopping floor. Here I am, minding my own business, and someone thinks it's funny to throw a book at me. Yeah. I don't know if this is some... Again, I think it's equal. Harry has no subtlety of, I guess, ghost etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think Myrtle is just always determined to be offended.
Yeah, I agree. That definitely seems to be the case. I mean... Do we know who threw the book at her?
No, we don't know who threw the book at her. We just find the book.
Okay. Yes. And the book ends up being a very important book. It looks pretty empty, but the, I think it's the cover says T.M. Riddle. Or it was on the inside of the first page. I'm sorry. I imagined it like embossed or something, but.
I think it might be embossed in the movie.
Oh, okay.
Probably for visual effect.
That would make sense. Yeah, so they pick this up. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they put two and two together that Ron recognizes the name because he had to spend his whole detention cleaning up Tom Riddle's trophy.
Yes. And he belched some slugs in there, which is pretty gross. But now I'm kind of like... Like I said, I know who this is. So this wasn't a big reveal for me just because, I mean, I know I'm very, very, very late to the game as far as reading Harry Potter, but things enter the pop culture lexicon. So this is interesting because we're getting a very important character's kind of background eventually.
And what I found very interesting is the dichotomy in reactions between Ron and Hermione because, and it's... kind of indicative of him. And again, Ron is not stupid.
No.
And so he, even before Harry tells them that, oh, this book has memories, like, he is immediately like, don't touch it. And Harry's like, why the hell not? And he's like, there are really creepy books out there that if you're not careful, they can do nasty crap to you.
This was a, I'm glad you mentioned this part of the book, because it definitely seems like some commentary. And, you know, we can really look more deeply into that as far as, you know, Harry's like, dangerous. How could it be dangerous? And he says, you'd be surprised. And then it made me think of immediately how Harry Potter, I believe, was on the list of banned books for, it might still be in some places, but.
Yes, indeed. Like, again, the notion of dangerous ideas. Because again, when you burn books, you're not burning the paper. You're not burning the leather cover. You're burning the idea. You're trying to exterminate the existence of that thought.
Right. This just has a comical, very like kiddish sort of, you know, some old witch in Bath had a book that you can never stop reading. Like, it's just, these are kind of silly, but I'm thinking about the book about burning books. Is it Fahrenheit 451 or something?
Oh yeah. Never read it, but yeah.
Yeah. I didn't read it either. I watched the movie on HBO. So, but the same, you know, like the concept, like you said, burning ideas, but this book, you know, they do pick it up and there isn't any sort of like physical harm that happens immediately. It's empty.
Yeah. And so when they show it to Hermione, Hermione's really excited about it because she's so used to seeing books in a benevolent fashion. And she's thinking like, you know, even if it is like magical book, it's automatically a good magical book. Whereas Ron's made an assumption that it could be a bad magical book. And what we're shown in the parameters of this chapter, what we see is kind of neutral.
Yes. Yeah.
Because we don't exactly know who to trust and who not.
Right. Right. And when it comes to the exchange here later on, I mean, it was just more interesting than it was like any sort of evil thing yet. But I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah. So Hermione finally is able to leave the hospital wing.
Has the whiskers and she's de-whiskered.
Yeah, de-whiskered, deferred. I can't get the image out of my head of furry fan fiction that Kevin mentioned.
Oh, God. Thanks for that, Kevin.
The one thing I did notice about, again, in Hermione thinking that maybe the book could be helpful is, you know, it's determined, and we're never given a date, but we say that this book is from 50 years ago. So with Harry being born in 1980 and him being like 12 and almost 13. So right now, February 1993, that is the date, the time right now in the book.
Okay. Okay.
So to have been 50 years ago, that basically would have been 1942 or 1943.
Okay.
And that's just interesting to me because like that would have been in the midst of World War II.
Okay. Yeah.
And the whole implications of, you know, it's not really even mentioned in Tom Riddle's memory, you know, the war or anything. Like, in a way, they're up in this castle in the Highlands, you know, in the countryside, which in a way is what the British government did when things got really bad and London was being bombed so badly, is that they forced the children to evacuate to the countryside.
Oh, that's a really interesting connection.
Because that's the whole premise of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is the kids go to this old professor's house, not because they want to or he's like a particular relative of theirs. They're going because they're being forced out of the urban areas because of the war.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. Well, it also makes me think like how much the Muggle world influences the Wizarding world. I mean, are any sort of like big Muggle world events portrayed here, or is that just, or we totally
know? I don't know. It's interesting because as I look back on the series, I think that, you know, particularly for this specific character, knowing when his childhood was and when he was going to Hogwarts, you would have think they would have mentioned the war in some capacity, but I don't think they really do. I think that's the whole reason behind the Fantastic Beasts franchise.
Oh, yes. Okay. Okay.
Anyway, moving on, Harry couldn't explain even to himself why he didn't just throw Riddle's diary away. Did you ever keep a diary?
I did, and I still do. Do you? Did you, and do you?
I did. I went through on and off phases where I would write in it religiously and sometimes like not at all. I feel like I've sort of balanced where I don't really write. Again, I don't really write about myself anymore. Or if I do, it's purely in poetry at this point, if it's not, you know, my novel.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, I don't like, it's not like a daily thing. I'd usually try to do it like full moon, new moon. And I usually like pull an oracle card and reflect on that. That's kind of been just like part of that little practice. But it's always interesting to look back and see, you know, the thoughts and feels and either cringe or go, oh my God, I'm still dealing with that nonsense. So that's why I've enjoyed it. I enjoy that practice. Now, if I could have something like this diary, that would be, I don't know if I'd want to do it. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to say. Even if you wanted to use it benevolently, it's still kind of creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not sure yet if past person knows who they're talking to in the future. This is all new and I haven't quite nailed it down yet. So
they end up doing a little digging, and the only really other things they can find about Tom Riddle is that he was like a prefect, he was a head boy, but it doesn't say why he was given that trophy for special services to the school. And Ron is just making the comments. He sounds like Percy, prefect, head boy, probably top of every class. You say that like it's a bad thing, said Hermione's slightly hurt voice.
Oh, goodness. That was...
Yeah, because it's... Percy is a sort of comic relief, and he is considered pompous, but is what anything he's doing really bad?
No, he's just like a... He's just doing his thing. I mean, I agree with Hermione. It's not a bad thing. I'm like... Now I'm trying not to spoil things for myself, because I'm like... I'm asking myself, like, what was Riddle's intention? Because I feel like with Percy and, you know, Hermione, they're just kind of doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do. I don't know if Tom Riddle has the same sort of
benevolent intention.
Yes, exactly.
So I love this jab at adolescence, you know, with Professor Sprout and the Mandrakes.
Yes.
Madame Pomfrey was pleased to report that the Mandrakes were becoming moody and secretive, meaning that they were fast leaving childhood. So the moment their acne clears up, they'll be ready for repotting again, Harry heard her telling Filch kindly one afternoon. So yeah, basically having the Mandrakes mirror, you know, human adolescence.
I mean, the only thing that I was offended about there is I'm an adult and I still have acne and I am still moody. So I don't know. But yes, she is obviously taking a little dig at adolescence. It also is interesting how long these guys have taken to... I'm just thinking about the petrified people, how long they've been petrified for.
Yeah, because Professor Sprout procured the Mandrakes, you know, pure not because of the... attack. That was in her curriculum beforehand. So imagine if it wasn't in her curriculum and it would take even longer, because after the first person, or, you know, the first feline that was attacked, she would have had just started then.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Well, then we get to visit Ernie McMillan, and he is still not okay with Harry. He's still hesitant of him. And then we have Peeves, who Kevin in our last episode said is a little comic relief. I think he's kind of a nuisance, is dancing around and singing "Oh Potter, You Rotter." And then
then we get Gilderoy Lockhart, and I'm just thinking, how dare Gilderoy Lockhart desecrate the sanctity of Valentine's Day with his rubbish.
Amen to that. I am not one of these anti-Valentine's Day people.
Neither am I. For someone who has had very few relationships, as I've had, and has spent the majority of Valentine's Day days thus far, you know, single, I never hated it the way other people did. Like, to me, it was like, yay, candy wrapped in red and pink tin foil. Woo.
That's what I would always say. I liked the colors. Like, I like the, I just think I love pink and red, and I don't know. So I never had too big of a problem with it. I did used to call it Single Awareness Day, because I, too, have not had very many relationships. But I also had a very sweet friend who would send me flowers to make me feel better. So
So I never was against Valentine's Day. And so because of that, I don't like it when Lockhart, you know, makes a mockery of it with his idea of Valentine's. And of course, it's all self-serving. He's just doing it because he wants people to send him Valentine's, not to boost morale of the school. Although it does show a level of intelligence that he at least is self-aware enough to kind of block his, at least slightly conceal his self-serving nature, that, oh, this will be good for the students to make themselves feel better and like forget things and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So as much as I don't dislike Valentine's Day, I really did dislike this as a kid, like growing up and having this stupid, we used to call them candy grams. And, you know, there was like a little fundraiser. I don't think anybody sang. Maybe they did. And I was not anybody. Nobody sang.
Or you blocked it out.
Maybe that's what happened. It was a trauma that I blocked. But this is that part. I was just like, oh gosh, this is.
I didn't have any traumatizing events from childhood. I don't know. It was kind of the practice, at least in my school or my community, where you bought like tiny little, you know, Valentine's Day cards, like a set of 20, 25. You gave one to each person in your class. And then, you know, I think in my friend group, select a group of people, you know, you send like the little candy grams. Like, I don't recall ever feeling rejected or left out.
I think it was more in middle school that I mean, it was just like, I don't know, man. I just can imagine the humiliation here, and especially poor Harry, which maybe I'm not seeing it, but do you think Jenny sent this to him? I kind of don't. 50. You know who sent it to him. So I just don't think it was Jenny. I think she's a little too bashful. And why are we mentioning the Dark Lord? Like, it's just weird.
And also, you got to think that, you know, Harry probably, you know, he only sees Jenny's crush on him just because he's in the periphery of his life as his best friend's sisters. That doesn't mean there aren't any other little girls just fawning over him because he's the quote unquote boy who lived.
Right. Right. So this focus on Jenny, I was just like, no, 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 that can't be it. And especially the little singing, the little song that is sung sounds a little too dark, honestly, to be from Jenny.
Yeah, the whole dwarfs with the wings and the harps, not a good look.
Not a good look is a great way to leave that there.
Yeah, and then my takeaway was this, whereas Malfoy is even more of a scumbag because he wanted to read what he thought was Harry's diary.
Yes, and I was so grateful in that moment that it was blank, because I just imagine somebody, you know, again, putting myself in Harry's shoes, reading mine, and it just being absolutely humiliating. And obviously that was what he was hoping to achieve, but was let down when there's nothing in it. But this is also where they had a little, Harry is more upset that he took the diary because he needs it. He wants to do something with it. So we bust the wands out and start wand fighting again, I guess.
The term, I believe, is dueling.
Dueling, yes.
At least you're not like Kevin. If you listen, you know, throughout the whole series of, you know, Amanda and Kevin's podcast, of course, Kevin, more often than not, will, whenever there's a phrase of Harry pulled out his wand, he will always make some phallic remark.
I wanted to, but I was trying to keep it above board or whatever for our wholesome podcast. I don't know how wholesome it is, but yes. So he uses the Expelliarmus. Is that right?
Expelliarmus.
See, I'm horrible at these words.
You know, a lot of this stuff is Latin. So expel, you know, repel something, and armus, like the arms as in like weapons.
So dearm, basically, is there?
Yeah, to disarm someone, literally in Latin.
That, well, I, apparently success.
Which is why I get even more pissed off at particularly like priests who are critical of Harry Potter, because as priests, they know Latin and they should not be perpetuating this garbage that these spells are harmful or could actually do some crazy shit.
I didn't know that's what they were saying. That's pretty funny.
Right? Well, at least some were saying. But again, yeah. For anyone, any sort of educated priest, Catholic or otherwise, who knows Latin, if they were espousing those views, I am ashamed of you.
Yeah, I am too.
It's not that I doubt that my shame means anything to them.
Who knows? Maybe it does. Maybe it will. Well, so then we have that exchange, and Harry gets to continue to have the diary, thank goodness, especially because there wasn't anything juicy there. But then he starts writing in it, I think because he was like, well, I'll just go for it. And then the diary starts writing back.
This is like the creepy guy in the chat room who you don't know who's on the other side.
Ooh, yeah, those are like, you're giving me flashbacks to the early days of the internet that I remember.
It's weird. Like, I wouldn't say my dad was a computer pornographer. I wouldn't say that my dad really censored me on, you know, my internet time. I don't know, for whatever reason, whether I was like smart or just sheer luck, I never as a young, you know, tween or teenage girl got sucked into the deep dark web and never was in a sort of bad situation like that. Like, did you ever get any of that?
No, thank goodness. No. I mean, I think I've made the mistake of stumbling on some websites that I was like, I learned some things. That's what I would say. But no, thankfully I don't have any traumatic experience. I think that's a little,
Again, I think I was safe in the sense that I was too busy with fan fiction.
Hey, that's all good. I don't remember what I was obsessing over for a long time. It was Romeo and Juliet. So I don't know what that says.
Yeah, the only time I remember, I'm just thinking, you know, just like early days of dealing with people on the internet, didn't know who they were. Because I remember when I was at the height of my quote unquote fanfic, you know, career, when I was writing the most often, is I did get a few, I got two requests to, you know, translate some of my works, one into Spanish and one into Portuguese. And so I was just like trying to figure out who these people were. It's like, are they legit? And, you know, I gave them my permission and, you know, yeah, they translated it like normally. And I'm like, okay, these people aren't scheming. Bitches.
Yeah, well, you never know. I feel like it's of
I think I told you the story of, you know, this wasn't even when I was a teenager, this was just like two years ago, where I wanted to do a project of creating a sort of anthology of pagan based and nature based poetry. And I told people that, you know, I'll like assemble it and I can publish it on Amazon, and all the proceeds can go to like an environmental like charity or nonprofit or whatever of our choosing. And I got so many people who said, like, who basically thought I was going to steal everyone's poetry, publish the book, and take all the royalties for myself.
Yeah, it's too bad that people don't trust each other. And I mean, I had a situation where I thought I sold a piece of artwork and it turned out to be somebody who just wanted to steal my, you know, information. So thankfully everything was okay. But I feel like that both of those things, like, you had a really good intention and people are goofy. And I guess I had just like a, here's my work, somebody buy it. And the guy was like, yeah, sure. And then I realized, oh, he's pulling my leg. So I guess, and then I had another weird experience, both of them on Instagram. I don't know, but with somebody being a troll.
Yeah, mine were on Facebook, because one of them was real. Like, I posted on one Facebook group and the guy was like, who are you? Like, I don't know anything about you, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, this is my website if you want to know who I am. And it got to a point where even the admin, I don't remember which group, the admin of that group is like, okay, dude, you need to like chill.
Yeah, goodness. Well, I'm sorry, because
the unfortunate reality is that there are Tom Riddles out there.
Yes, there are. We've encountered our own personal Tom Riddles, and so Harry asks him the big question that we're all dying to know, like, what's the Chamber of Secrets? And he's like, of course I know about the Chamber of Secrets. And then basically tells him all about it. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead too far, but it's kind of throws Hagrid under the bus.
Yeah, eventually. Well, first he pulls Harry into his memory.
Oh, yeah.
And the first scene that we get is a conversation between Tom Riddle and Dumbledore's predecessor, you know, Armando Dippet. That was his name.
Okay.
And I actually was looking on, like, Harry Potter Wiki today. Apparently, Dippet, this guy, this previous headmaster, he was born in 1637.
Wow. Okay.
And
so he's been there.
And then he, you know, eventually, you know, canon suggests that that Dumbledore became headmaster in, like, the late 60s, early 70s. And okay. So, and that the guy, Dippet, this guy died in 1992. And so the idea is this guy was over 350 years old.
Oh my goodness.
And he's never mentioned as sort of having special powers. So now that this has really messed with my notion of headcanon, because if wizards, if, you know, it's already been established that wizards can kind of live longer than muggles, but I always presume that to be like over 100 or maybe 200 years at most.
Okay. Yeah.
Like that was always how I perceived it. And now this messed with my brain, because if you can live to 350 as a wizard naturally, then what's the point of Nicholas Flamel's Philosopher's Stone?
That's a great, I think you have detected a little bit of a hole in there.
Yeah, anyway, I digress. So we get not really much we can say on it. There's a huge variety in how long wizards can live. And I don't know if there's a sense of that a sheer magical power can sort of like trump, like, you know, the fragility of old age or whatever.
Interesting. So many little avenues you could take this whole series and just...
Anyway, but that's... Yeah. But his age and that's not the point. The point is that Riddle has put in a request. He wants to stay at Hogwarts over the summer. And he wants to do this because he literally has no family. Like, Harry goes back to the Dursleys, who, you know, they hate him. And so... Riddle is in a position where he is sent to the Muggle orphanage where he was like abandoned or, you know, left at.
Sounds familiar. Like not like a personally familiar, but being an orphan, like we were getting a little bit of patterns and parallels.
And even Harry admits later in the chapter or the next chapter that Harry, as much as he likes Hagrid and doesn't want to see any harm towards Hagrid, he could sympathize with Riddle's desperation.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he is thinking about going back to be with the Dursleys and he's like, heck no.
So between Dippet and Riddle, Dippet's like, you know, even normally it would be unconventional to have you stay over the summer, but we really can't even do it now, especially when a girl has just died. And so, like, it would be very irresponsible of me to let a student, like, we're even considering closing the school, like, for good. So, like, it's just totally impractical. And Riddle really starts to panic and is like, what if the guy was caught? And Dippet's like, Riddle, is there something you would like to share with the class?
Yeah. So, yeah. And he says no, but, you know, I don't. So is he about to throw somebody under the bus? Anyway, he's dismissed. And then he encounters who I can only see in my mind's eye as Jude Law, a 50 years younger Dumbledore. And Dumbledore at this point is a prefect, right?
Prefect. Dumbledore is born in like the 1890s.
Okay. So
Dumbledore at this point, he's like in his 40s, 50s. Like he's the Transfiguration teacher.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So for some reason I thought he was a student. Maybe it was because I'm losing my mind, but,
Like if we take the premise that Dumbledore is like, you know, 100 or 110, and then he'll be like, you know, 50 or like 40, you know, okay, in this time frame.
I'm just going to continue to picture Jude Law at this point because
his perfect little like vest and tie and pocket square.
Perfect. Loved it. Loved it all. Movie.
I haven't seen it yet fully, but I do appreciate that casting. And I appreciate the comment that Jude Law says, like, you know, the man you are at like 40 is not the same man that you are at 140.
Ain't that the truth? I mean, I feel like that in my 20s and 30s and 40s and all of that. So it's interesting. Well, Now, so we're creeping toward where bumps into Hagrid, who is hanging out with some creepy creature that basically tears on out of the chamber, if I'm
and correct. And Riddle is just like, maybe you didn't mean for it to kill anyone, but you can't, you know, be trying to tame all these magical creatures. And so Riddle tries to capture the beast, but the beast, you know, runs away, and Hagrid, like, tackles Riddle before, you know, he can, like, you know, give chase to the beast.
What a scene. And based on the description, I know what this thing is, and I'm not loving it. It seems like it might be a giant spider.
It's just so sad for Hagrid. And that is where the memory ends, and Harry sits up and tells Ron, it was Hagrid, Ron. Hagrid opened the Chamber of Secrets 50 years ago.
Man, sometimes these kids really think they're just so smart and they have it all figured out. And I think what I've learned in reading the first book is don't trust them. Don't trust that they know everything. So they're leading me on.
Then we have chapter 14, Cornelius Fudge. Harry, Ron, and Hermione had always known that Hagrid had an unfortunate liking for large and monstrous creatures. During their first year at Hogwarts, he had tried to raise a dragon in his little wooden house, and it would be a long time before they forgot the giant three-headed dog he christened Fluffy. So I like the, in a way, it's a very good Harry the Writer, you know, building up for people who don't know who Tom Riddle is right. The idea of that it is believable from Hagrid's history that he's not a malevolent guy, but he also underestimates the damage that certain of his preferred creatures can do.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, it's very believable that Hagrid, you know, I think that it's pretty well established that Hagrid isn't, he has a kind heart, and it just things, like you said, he underestimates these creatures. And they have no idea who Tom Riddle is. They have no, just that it just is a friendly, you know, chat room friend, I guess, responding to their chats right now.
Exactly. And, you know, there are some people who really dislike the whole baby Norbert sequence in the first book.
What?
Yeah, like one of my favorite podcasters, Natasha Winters, she and her co-host Rashawn, they did both a unspoiled like reading of Harry Potter and then a reread.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah, like that, like 4 years probably combined, but I remember her saying, like, neither of them really like the baby Norbert sequence in book one. And part of it is because, in a sense, and I'm not saying they don't have a point. I'm just biased because I adore dragons. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that the Norbert sequence really didn't serve anything particularly to the plot, or the plot could have been, you know, pushed in another manner in book one. And that the baby Norbert sequence was purely a mean to establish Hagrid's character for this sort of conflict and beyond.
Hmm. That's interesting. I mean, I think I too enjoy a dragon, and I think it kind of helped establish some, you know, of the risks that he's willing to take, the trust that he's willing to give people that, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't take it out. I think it's also kind of a memorable, yeah, you know, ask some good questions too.
I think it's relevant enough to the plot because Hagrid gets the dragon from someone who wants a piece of information from him and tricks him from it. So it does come back around to the bigger picture. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah. Well, they are also, when they're kind of reflecting on this new information, they're thinking about how Hagrid was kicked out and how I think they're just kind of building the case in their mind. They're talking about bumping into him at Nocturne Alley. So they're kind of thinking, well, this very well could be, you know, the person at fault.
Yeah. And so they go back at Houth, and finally they're like, do you think we should go and ask Hagrid about it? That'll be a cheerful visit, said Ron. Hello, Hagrid. Tell us, have you been setting anything Mad and Harry loose in the castle lately?
I like, again, with Ron's like lack of... Yeah, I mean, Ron can figure stuff out. That's some emotional intelligence there to realize, like, maybe we shouldn't just go, like, bombard him with this crazy accusation. Maybe we should just, you know, think about it a little bit.
In the end, they decided that they would not say anything to Hagrid unless there was another attack, and as more and more days went by with no whisper from the disemboweled voice, they became hopeful that they would never need to talk to him about why he had been expelled.
Yeah.
So, again, then we move to the second year's choosing their electives.
Yes. And then I get to ask you the question, out of these classes or any of the classes, which would be up your alley?
Yes, I actually did have this in my notes to ask you this question, which I know maybe they didn't mention all of them, but here I'm going to give you all the electives and I'll ask. So of all of these classes, I would want to do Care of Magical Creatures and Ancient Runes.
That is so funny. That's what I have highlighted. I had highlighted Ancient Runes because of the rune exercise at the end of this, but I definitely Care of Magical Creatures. That's what I would sign up for as well.
Yeah, I don't know if they mentioned all of them, but I know that all the available electives are Divination, Care of Magical Creatures, Ancient Runes, Muggle Studies, and Arithmancy.
Okay, what is that? I'm assuming it's math magic?
Yeah, arithmetic. Okay. Basically, real magical numerology.
Interesting. I would fail that class, so I can't go to that.
Although it is, you know, it is perceived as, you know, again, it is legitimate, like, mathematics, because, like, if you want to work at Gringotts, you have to be good with numbers, and so you have to have arithmancy and stuff.
That's interesting. The other interesting, I think that's interesting that you pointed out working at Gringotts, because they're also kind of talking about, like, life paths pretty early. You know, like Charlie was more of an outdoor type, so he went for a Care of Magical Creatures. And we also know he's, you know, playing with dragons, I think, in Egypt or something. So it's just weird to me to have them start thinking about this so young, but I don't think it's a bad thing. Muggle Studies is a soft option. I thought about the professor we spoke with and the humanities and kind of things like that. But all interesting. I mean, I won't say I would have been like Hermione and signed up for everything, but definitely would have done the Care of Magical Creatures.
Yeah. And I just noticed here, like, why are we hounding on Percy so much? Because what he's talking about with Harry, he's giving legitimately good advice.
Yeah, I don't know. He's...
So I think it's the question of, are they being fair in separating, you know, Percy's pompousness as, you know, it's not that we dislike Percy's, you know, intelligence or his dedication to the rules and order, or are we just stigmatizing him, or are we really disliking, you know, the arrogance he puts with those positions?
I don't know. You know, some of this, I wonder if it's just the perception as a kid too, you know, kind of how we're looking at him.
Yeah, like through their nerd.
Eyes. Right. Yeah. He's a rule follower. He wants to like think about the future or how crazy.
It must be deeply rooted in our like evolution as a species, because the idea of, again, just the notion of rebellion is cool.
Yeah, right.
And not even rebellion, like legitimate, like social justice, like rebellion. I would love if more teenagers put that sort of rebellious attitude towards legitimate causes.
Yes.
Like, I hate rebellion without a purpose. I want to do the absolute opposite because you said something.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like dealing with people like that. I don't, you know, I feel like that kind of in adulthood, some people become, you know, dismissive of certain things. But I think it's better to just, or like makes life more enjoyable to just like what you like and just, you know, kind of move on rather than trying to be rebellious against everything. And I think we've seen some teenagers put some of that rebellion to good use, which is awesome. So
yeah, which I will admit that Generation Z has been much better than us millennials in that regard, like using like K-pop fans using you know, social media to buy up all the Trump rally seats.
Yeah, that's awesome.
They've that was dope
stuff. Yes, they get like, on you all,
put it towards those things.
Right, exactly.
Not the, oh, my mom is such a bitch because I couldn't go to the mall.
Right, yeah. Let's not do that. Let's have the, I think the rallies, I'm thinking of the one I went to about after the shooting in Florida. Gosh, the school shooting in Florida, which is name, I'm, it, escapes
me. There are too many at this point, and that's the sad part.
There really are, and even this week. But that was kind of a activism inspired by, you know, teenagers really got that going. So good on you all. If you're talking about your mom being a bitch, maybe redirect that anger. I think that's the overall message here.
And then Harry makes his way back up to the dormitory. His part of the dormitory has been ransacked.
Yeah, which Neville points out to him.
What did you think of this?
I didn't quite know what to think. I think I'm so used to Harry, some weird shit happening to him, that it's kind of like par for the course at this time. But who would have done that? I guess possibly somebody searching for the diary. I don't think it would have been Malfoy, because they would have had to, and they even comment, they would have had to have had the password to get into the space. So,
or at least looked enough like a Gryffindor. Who's to say they didn't do what they did?
Yeah. Hermione is selling that stuff on the black market now. I don't know.
Well, if she was, I doubt she would have sold it to Malfoy directly. But they, yes. So they make it say that it has to be a Gryffindor. But what about a teacher?
Do you think it was a teacher? Gilderoy.
I'm just saying that all the teachers, or at least, I think it is, at least the heads of house, at least, if not all the teachers, have the passwords to all of the dormitories.
Well, that would only make sense. So, it was so funny that you mentioned that now. That should have grabbed my attention more. But I did kind of just go, okay, something weird happened to Harry's room, and I don't really know. Oh, and, you know, and then, of course, the diary's gone. But I don't know. I don't know who ransacked the room.
And now Riddle's diary is gone.
Yes.
This reminded me, because there is a ransacking scene in my novel that I'm writing, which I just made it to 18,000 words in my manuscript. Oh, bravo.
Nice. Bravo. It's a lot of writing you're doing there. Goodness.
3,000 words a week.
Whew.
Yeah, like I write 5 days a week. The only 2 days I don't write is when we podcast.
Yeah, that's, wow. Lots and lots of writing. Lots.
So then, what do we have next?
So this is where go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. No, this is where we get, you know, preparations for the Quidditch match, and they're going to be playing Hufflepuff.
Yeah, and I was fully prepping myself, like, just ready to get ready to read another Quidditch match, and it gets canceled.
But what happens beforehand?
Beforehand, we hear the voice again, and then Hermione has like an aha moment, and she immediately goes to the library, and Ron comments, because that's what Hermione does, said Ron, shrugging, when in doubt, go to the library. So she's on to something, she suspects.
And so they, the two boys, go to the, you know, Quidditch field, and game's about to start, and Professor McGonagall comes running onto the field with a megaphone.
And, yep, the match has been canceled, and she says,
yeah, you know things are bad if McGonagall is canceling Quidditch.
Right. She loves Quidditch. It is probably painful for her to speak these words right now.
So Harry and Ron are both surprised that McGonagall's like, you need to come with me.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, I feel like it's almost, again, I said par for the course already, but it's pretty common that they're having to leave a Quidditch match with a teacher. But this time it's because Hermione's been petrified.
With another girl, with a Ravenclaw.
Yeah. On poor Hermione, on the way to figure out, or to, you know, I don't know, cite her sources for this voice that Harry's hearing. I'm pretty sure she had this great idea, and now she is petrified. So she...
Some people suggest that Hermione should have, you know, at least expressed her theory to Ron, then she could have gone and gotten petrified when she was trying to confirm it. But honestly, I'm more like Hermione, where it's like, I don't want to blurt something out unless I'm really, really sure.
I can relate to that. I don't know how many times that I will do that during a workday. I will have to find documented evidence before I'm like, this is the thing, because I would have done the same thing as Hermione as well.
And so now that has happened, all this, like, curfew has been, like, moved up to, like, everyone has got to be back in their dorms by 6 p.m. each evening. They can't leave their dorms. They will be escorted to each class by a teacher. No student is to use the bathroom unaccompanied by a teacher.
Oh,
I feel especially bad for the Slytherins.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, have Snape, leering over you.
Yeah, that's not a pleasant thought. Man, how awful. But you also know that things are getting pretty serious. I mean, I feel like they let those kids kind of run free for most of the time. And now it's like you have to be escorted everywhere. So goodness.
And so basically everything's on lockdown in essence. And Harry and it's like, you know, we got to go talk to Hagrid. They realize with everything, security being so tight, that the only way they're going to get out is by super breaking the rules and using the invisibility cloak.
But glad that made an appearance. Again, it's only logical that that thing makes an appearance again. So glad they're utilizing it.
Yeah, so they wait for everyone to go to sleep and then get dressed again and then are able to sneak down to Hagrid's hut. And Hagrid greets them with a crossbow in his hand.
So there is serious danger if Hagrid's worried about it too. He's ready to take somebody out.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, like what, who were you thinking was going to come? Nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. Hagrid knows something's going wrong, but then he's I don't know if this is very British. In my mind, it was very British. He's getting some tea and some fruitcake and, you know, being kind to his guests, which good on him. And then they get another visitor pretty quickly after they arrive.
They don't have any chance to exchange any words, basically.
No.
Because they're British and the tea was more important.
Of course. I guess. I don't know.
For a half Persian household, like, we drink a lot of tea as well. It's like a very ritual with like nuts and chocolate and cute little cookies. But still, and that sort of thing, I would have set aside the tea for this very hefty conversation.
Well, good. Yeah, I guess they didn't even have time to even broach the subject. And then Dumbledore shows up and looks like Cornelius Fudge, the person that the chapter is named after. And he's also Ron's boss, the Minister of Magic.
His dad's boss.
Ron's dad's boss. I forgot word yeah. There, yes.
He's the equivalent of the Prime Minister. He is the Minister of Magic.
Okay.
Bad business, Hagrid, said Fledge in a rather clipped tones. Very bad business. Had to come. 4 attacks on Muggleborns. Things have gone far enough. Ministry's got to act. I want it understood, Cornelius, that Hagrid has my full confidence, said Dumbledore, frowning at Fledge. Look, Albus, said Fledge uncomfortably. Hagrid's record's against it. Ministry's got to do something. The school governors have been in touch. Yeah, so basically summing up this conversation is Cornelius Fudge is ultimately arresting Hagrid and taking him into custody. And he's blatantly admitting that he highly doubts that Hagrid did it. And is only doing it to save his own ass.
Admirable, right? Like, what a cool thing to do. But yeah, he definitely says, people are breathing down my neck. I have to do something, which I feel like there's a lot of crime shows and things like that that have that happen. I had a thought and it escaped me. But yeah, like, Azkaban. Honestly, scary. Go ahead.
Yeah, Azkaban. Like, this reminded me of, I don't know if I mentioned it or not before. Have you ever seen the Murdoch Mysteries?
I have not, no.
It's a very famous Canadian historical drama where in essence, it's Canadian Sherlock Holmes, where there's a super smart detective who solves crime, like in the late 19th and early 20th century. But it's really good because all the background characters are just as nuanced and developed, and so it's not just all about the detective. And so there's one episode in that series where the detective's boss, and the inspector, who is like this, you know, old school, but even there's a crime that a black man is suspected of doing, but even the sometimes, you know, racist, Inspector Yorkshireman, even he realizes that the black guy didn't do it and has to fight with like higher up officials in the constabulary to be like, I'm not going to arrest this man when I don't damn well, like, this whole, like trial is going to get thrown out of court, you know? And so just fighting the whole systemic racism of, like, I know it's obvious that this guy didn't do it, but others wanting to push it anyway for the public's assurance.
Yeah, that's awful. I mean, that's, I feel like,
it doesn't happen in history, still happens now.
No, very. And unfortunately, like, that it's people in these powerful positions when there's the heat's on them, or, you know, they feel like they have to act, and then somebody goes to jail or loses their life because somebody's, you know, feeling pressure. And, you know, speaking of extra pressure and irritation, our next guest at the Hagrid's Hut is Mr. Lucius Malfoy.
Yes. And even before that, you know, Fudge is like saying, oh, it won't be so bad, it's just temporary, you'll be let out with a full apology, as if that would compensate for wrongful imprisonment.
Yeah, that's, you know, I've watched like 60 Minutes or something, when somebody has been wrongfully imprisoned for years and they're like, okay, bye, here's a $20 Applebee's gift card. It's like, no, do better. And when he said a full apology, it's like, no, from my little understanding of Azkaban, that is not a place where, you know, an apology is going to make everything better. It's pretty dark, horrible place. So,
and what does this say? That yes, Fudge feels pressured, but also he's doing it because he can, because Hagrid is, you know, on the margins of this society. He can't use magic to the same capacity that even the kids can. And his only advocate is Dumbledore, but that's still just a professional relationship. So he's doing it because it's easy to do.
Yeah.
You know, Hagrid is an easy sacrificial lamb, and no one except Dumbledore or anyone, no one else is going to like form a protest in front of Azkaban to free Hagrid.
Yeah, that's too bad. Hagrid's a good guy.
And then, yeah, but as you said, slippery, slimy Lucius Malfoy comes in. Again, I hate him, but again, Lucius Malfoy is one of my favorite like secondary villains.
I think this is the first time, other than Draco's mention of him, that he's actually been present. Oh, no. He was in Nocturnally, but that Harry is aware of his, like, that Lucius still doesn't. This is funny, though, to a connection to make. Lucius didn't know Harry was there the first time they kind of encountered each other, and also doesn't know he's here now. But of course, there's another dig at, you know, I guess the income of Hagrid, because, my dear man, please believe me, I have no pleasure at all in being inside your, you call this a house. I was like, dude, just F off. I don't know. Any opportunity to kind of put themselves above somebody, it seems like they'll take pretty easily.
And Lucius Malfoy shows this parchment that has ultimately called for Dumbledore's suspension.
Yeah, stuff's really getting real there, where they're telling Dumbledore that he's basically not fit to serve, so he's got to go, which you just know that there's something is bubbling under the surface here with all of this.
Yeah, and of course we know that Lucius's intentions are obviously bad, but in the grand scheme of things, is it really unreasonable to suspend someone who has failed to protect children? Like, and this is the wizard who supposedly kind of indirectly ended World War II in 1945.
So do you think they think he's like losing his touch, or just
I don't know. I'm mentioning to the point of the whole secret joke on the other Harry Potter podcast, Failed Pedagogy of Hogwarts. Let's say that this happened at a public school where four kids were like, I don't know, petrified. I don't know what a modern day equivalent would be. Like, what if they suddenly like not dropped dead, but dropped into comas, like, you know, and yeah. It didn't seem the principal was doing anything or making any progress.
Right. So when you frame it that way, yeah, it doesn't seem very unreasonable that they would be like, the person at the head, they have to, you know, remove them for, yeah.
And then again, but we're also operating under the premise that, you know, even Fudge is startled by this because, again, because of Dumbledore's prestige, it's like if Dumbledore is having trouble, you know, figuring this out, like anyone who would replace him is not going to figure it out either.
That's a, yeah, that, who's, is Lucius going to step up? Probably not. Like, so it sounds like they don't have a good plan B to help sort this out.
Yeah, and Gada felt really icky about Fudge because you want to, like, try, I don't know. We'll see Fudge in a variety of capacities throughout these books, but okay. This is our introduction of him, so. Not the most flattering. But even if you want to say that, okay, even he's not as bad as Lucius because he didn't want to kick Dumbledore out, but he's only coming to Dumbledore's defense because Dumbledore is a rich, powerful white dude.
Yeah.
And knows there's going to be a brouhaha if Dumbledore is ousted. Even if it's for good reasons, the fact is that Dumbledore is powerful and taking him from Hogwarts is not the same as taking Hagrid from Hogwarts.
Right, right. Well, doesn't
he is Fudge.
Yeah. I have so many other silly questions. Like, isn't this where he lives? Like, where's he going to go? I guess he's just going to hang out in his, like, office. I don't know.
Dumbledore graciously accepts this suspension, and he's just like, however, you will find I will have only truly left this school when none are here loyal to me. You will also find that help will always be given at Hogwarts to those who ask for it. And then
go ahead.
Go. What was your comment?
I just was going to say that was a pretty, I loved that because it was pretty, like, boss move there to just say, like, just so you know, it's, you know, I can physically be gone, but I have my loyal, you know, my people that are loyal to me. I just thought that was a pretty, again, just kind of with Dumbledore being very astute and, I don't know, thoughtful. I thought that was a great way, a great note for him to leave on.
So he exits the cabin and then Hagrid is like, if anyone wanted to find out some stuff, all they'd have to do would be to follow the spiders. That'd lead them right. That's all I'm saying. And all the grown-ups leave.
And then the poor...
And that is the end of chapter 14.
Yeah. Well, that was quite the chapter. We're losing some people. We're following spiders. Don't know how I feel about that. But
is there anything specifically that triggered your arachnophobia?
I'm sure if I dug really deep, I could find it, but I'm not sure. It's gotten better as I've gotten older, but it's been pretty bad for a while, which is fine. Okay.
Which I've realized I've gotten less arachnophobic as I've gotten older, specifically in moving where I am now, like out in the boonies. And so, like, I'll climb the stairs and there'll be, like, you know, a spider that has woven his web, you know, between the railings, and I'll be like, ooh, look at the stripes on his legs, or I wonder what species he is. And, like, so I'm just like, ooh, ah, nature.
That I'm getting there, but it's going to be a while.
Alrighty then. And so we can move on to Gothic Geek Out. So, what were your Gothic elements that came to mind?
I think the writing in the journal and the journal talking back, I mean, it's magical objects, sure. But I guess just, you know, so many books that we've read are in that epistolary, I believe it's called, style of writing. I'm thinking about, you know, my favorite, Dracula. So that kind of gave me some Gothic vibes there. What was yours?
Same thing, Riddle's Diary, because It's not just the sort of magical object. And in a lot of ways, you know, we've talked about in Sublime Gothic, Shadow of the Wind, The Historian. So these books that are given significance. And then, you know, the whole notion of the memory, a huge tenet in Gothic literature, the past.
Right. Great point.
Uncovering secrets from the past.
Yeah. Pretty cool to have, like, something to tell you those secrets in such an interesting way.
So, yeah, we both agree, you know, nothing can beat Riddle's Diary of these two chapters.
Yeah, definitely not in this
one. Yeah. And now we can move on to Tarot of the Day.
All right.
And I drew the card, and it's a really good one for this episode. It is the Eight of Swords. The typical imagery, traditional imagery that goes with the Eight of Swords is, you know, these eight swords, you know, kind of stabbed in the ground, and in between all of them is a woman who is blindfolded and bound.
Oh, wow.
The Eight of Swords reveals that you feel trapped and restricted by your circumstances. You believe your options are limited with no clear path out. You might be in an unfulfilling job, an abusive relationship, a significant amount of debt, or a situation way out of alignment with your inner being. You are now trapped between a rock and a hard place with no resolution available. However, take note that the woman in the card is not entirely imprisoned by the Eight of Swords around her. And if she wanted to escape, she could. She merely needs to remove the blindfold and free herself from the self-imposed bindings that hold her back.
Interesting.
So okay. What I get out of this is, again, to me, the Eight of Swords is ultimately, I feel trapped. This is the I feel trapped card.
Okay.
That is the essence of the Eight of Swords. And what perfect way to pick it up in these chapters, because that is ultimately Hagrid's position.
Yeah, that is definitely Hagrid's position. Because they're like, basically, hi, you're going to be the fall guy. You're going to Azkaban for a while. Not much you can do about it. So
he's the one who has to fall on the sword.
Yeah, he does. He does. He has to fall on the sword.
But then also, you know, Dumbledore is also kind of trapped, because even though he's physically maybe a more powerful wizard, more magically knowing than Lucius, he still has to work within the framework of the socio-political system, and so he can't really defy a edict that's been signed by all 12 of the governors, regardless of, again, it's questionable, as Hagrid suggests, like how many of these governors had to be bullied or blackmailed into like going along with Lucius's agenda.
Yeah, not a good situation. I mean, these chapters that we read today leave both Hagrid and Dumbledore in not great situations, and kind of Harry and Ron, because I also remember from, you know, the last bit of advice Hagrid gives is follow the spiders, and Ron has expressed his arachnophobia earlier in the book, so kind of trapped by this, having to face this fear. It seems like he will have to be facing this fear soon.
Yeah, and then I'm trying to think of anyone else in the chapters who is trapped.
I guess the people that are petrified are trapped.
Yeah, like Hermione gets trapped.
Yeah.
But yeah, really good card. Eight of Swords, always the I'm trapped card.
I'm trapped card. That's good to remember.
Yeah. Alrighty, and now we can move on to the rune of the day.
All right.
Let's see if I can pull one out. Okay, I've got one that basically kind of looks like an arrow. Like, I don't know if that's supposed to hold my represent a tree or like the antlers. I don't know. Let me look it up.
All right.
Let's see. My kitty is meowing outside the door, but he can't come yet because I'm not done podcasting. So this rune is known as Tiwaz.
Okay.
And it's kind of the corresponding with the letter T.
Okay.
The keywords are courage, victory, strength, passion, masculine energy. Tiwaz represents the qualities of the god Tyr and is associated with courage, strength, and the forward-moving nature of masculine energy. Tyr proved his bravery and dedication to his community of gods by sacrificing his right hand in order to keep Fenris Wolf from harming Odin. As such, Tiwaz speaks to the need to put our causes above our personal desires, if the greater good requires it. If you are facing a decision that involves potential discomfort, in order to achieve a positive outcome, Tiwaz is signalizing that you possess the courage and ability to withstand the sacrifice and emerge victorious. You are ready for the challenge, provided you act with integrity and remain true to your inner knowledge. Stand your ground and keep the faith, and your ultimate success will be recognized and respected by others.
Well, when you said masculine energy, I just kind of started fixating on that. And I was thinking about the scene at Hagrid's house, and there were no female teachers, anything present. But I think that's just me thinking about that particular scene. What is your interpretation of
my interpretation of this? Is Dumbledore is exemplifying the virtues of Tiwaz, because he's in a situation that, again, if he had his choice, he would not want to leave the school at this particularly dangerous time but he's willing to sacrifice like his pride or his, you know, discomfort for the sake of, you know, the greater good.
Yeah, that's.
And then he knows. And then when everything really goes to pot, I know they'll beg for me back.
Right. that's some confidence there, Dumbledore. I admire that for sure. I don't have anything to add. I mean, like,
I'm just thinking masculine energy, like, in a way, when I think of courage, masculine energy makes me think of the old school, like, chivalrous knight. And in a way that Tom Riddle is trying to put on that facade when he confronts Hagrid. It's just like, okay, you know, a girl has died. I'm sure you didn't mean it, but this must be done. I don't like doing it, but I must do it.
Yeah.
So to me, he's like kind of showing those, like, you know, would-be masculine qualities of, like, I'm doing what's right, even though it makes me, like, uncomfortable to, like, throw Hagrid on their boss, aka it doesn't really make him feel that uncomfortable.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, those are my thoughts for these chapters and T-Watts.
I think that's good. I don't have anything to add.
Alrighty then. And now we move on to fan fiction time.
So I feel like mine's a little easy, but I'm just going to go with it. What if we knew who what if there was more known about Tom Riddle? Like, if we knew who this diary was from, you know, like I said, I'm aware of who it is, but what if we were privy to that? I'm guessing Malfoy would have really wanted that diary that much more. I'm not sure, but
I'm thinking if Harry knew who Tom Riddle was, then I would like to think that that would trump the sort of secretive, like, kid stuff and be like, Dumbledore, here you go.
Yeah, he would have just, and then I've also been hearing voices, maybe he would own up to that finally, we don't know, but
yeah, I don't know about that. But I you know, because again, with the voices being in its mind, it's easy to ignore or at least avoid, like, the physicality of the diary. And if you knew who Tom Riddle was at an earlier date, which again, it shows the society has completely forgotten about Tom Riddle, because again, this is really, really old, and you know, Tom Riddle manifests himself years later, but I don't think there's very few people at this point who remember that's who Tom Riddle has become.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I don't know that how deep it goes yet, but I just know that eventually somehow this person's going to become that person thing. I don't know what the hell to call him, but
it's hard to describe, but yeah.
What about yours?
My scenario is, what if Hagrid had met the whatever figure he had the crossbow for?
Who
could that person be? Like, what would have happened if Harry and Ron just stood there as he shot someone?
These kids need just that much more drama, right? They've already seen a dead unicorn. Kids are being petrified.
At this point, you think they'd be the type where it's like, Hagrid will help you bury the body?
Maybe. I don't know how deep their whatever goes. But now all I can think about I suspect it's this furry-legged creature, which it sounds pretty, you know, he seems to not want to put down an animal of any sort, but it's almost like he knows what's causing this chaos. There's a lot of conflicting stuff going on right now. That's all I'll say in this chapter. There's people being petrified. There's like just the Chamber of Secrets is open. There's this understanding of what happened in the past.
Creepy books.
Creepy books. It's just like it's all kind of, I just don't think it all ties together. I think all elements, maybe it is, who knows? I'll probably be proven wrong and eating my words, but I don't know yet. I don't know. I think it would be, I don't even know who we'd shoot at. What are your thoughts about your own theory there?
Well, it's just the interesting, because depending on if he knows who Tom Riddle is, like, is he the type of person who could be shot and harmed?
I don't know.
Yeah. Like, it's hard, you know, it's hard because you know the sort of very end game with Tom Riddle, yes. but you don't know exactly how all these moving pieces are working yet, which again, this, I don't think people appreciate enough the intricacies of Chamber of Secrets. It's a quieter mystery, but it's good.
Yeah. Well, it's got me stumped so far, so.
Alrighty then, and that concludes Harry Potter and Chamber of Secrets chapters 13 and 14. Tune in next time for chapters 15, Aragog, and chapter 16, titular chapter, The Chamber of Secrets.
Oh, finally.
Yes. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.